Welcome to the Scandinavian Product Podcast. I'm Afonso and I'm your host. My guest today is the one and only Hope Guyon. Hope works together with Teresa Torres, teaching and coaching product teams on all things continuous discovery. She's the founder of Fearless Product and is one of the 7 featured product coaches in Marty Kagan's new book, Transformed. Sometimes we meet people that we immediately know are special. Hope is one of them. And in this conversation, we talked about so many things, and it's the evidence why I've been such a big fan of Hope's work for a few years now. We discussed why is continuous discovery so important, how to move from leading with outputs to outcomes, why shifting to outcomes requires both an upskilling in leadership and teams, why most transformations require bringing in strong product leaders, how product teams should approach business outcomes, why formulating and deciding on outcomes is a two-way negotiation between teams and leaders, and so much more. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure you subscribe and please leave a review. These things really help the podcast. Also, make sure you don't miss out on our next spicy episode. I sat down with Marty Kagan to discuss all things transformed and product management theater. All right, without further ado, I bring you Hope Guyon.
All right, we're live. Hope, how are you today?
I'm great. Excited to get to chat with you.
Likewise. Thanks for joining the podcast. So you are a former chief product officer. You are the founder of Fearless Product. And you work together with Teresa Torres, teaching product teams on how to adopt continuous discovery habits. And you've even been featured in Marty Kagan's new book, Transformed, as one of the product coaches. So I do have to ask, why is continuous discovery so important?
Yeah, I think it's because like a lot of the hard decisions we have to make is deciding what to build. There's high opportunity cost, there's, you know, risk in building the things that don't deliver value to our customers or our company, and discovery can help mitigate a lot of those risks, which is why it's sort of one of those core tenets of working in the product operating model. So the two go very well together.
Absolutely. And from what I understand, Hope, there's a big issue in our industry, which is output-driven management, which basically makes the whole discovery really difficult because then there's nothing to discover. So I want to dig into that a bit with you. So what's the difference between output-driven management and outcome-driven management? Outputs, outcomes, please enlighten us for folks yes. who've never been aware of this.
So here's what I will say. Like, there is a spectrum within most companies around the degree to which they are practicing outcome and output-oriented product management. There are companies who are outcome-oriented who still have some high-integrity commitments, which are specific outputs. The key is what's the spectrum? Like, are you way on the one end where it's completely output-oriented, which means somebody, maybe an executive team, is deciding what to build? They're typically funding based on the belief that if they build that thing, it will deliver value, versus outcome-driven, which is here's the measures of success that we want to create. This is how we'll know if we're likely to succeed in achieving our financial objectives. And so there's the spectrum, and every company has to navigate that. But more and more companies are recognizing that if they are too prescriptive in terms of outputs, and the teams are working towards dates, which typically go together, right? We want you to go build this thing, and we're tracking how, you know, are you on time, on budget, to whatever the predefined scope is. There's very little room for teams to spend any time de-risking that, which means all the risk is pushed into after it's been released. And so there's many, many effective techniques that can help teams and companies de-risk these really high opportunity cost bets that they're making. And that's where product discovery comes into play. So not every company, not every member of the leadership team has that level of recognition that they are, in fact, by being prescriptive, which feels so certain, right? It's tangible. I defined something. There's a document describing it. It feels like they're de-risking when in fact they're increasing risk for their companies because they're not giving any room and not creating any time, space, or valuing, decreasing the risks associated with each of those commitments that they're expecting from their teams. So this is why more and more companies are moving to what is a measure of success that we want to work towards and how can we give teams guardrails? Like this is, you know, we're providing some strategic context, who our customers are, what success might look like, but giving the teams latitude to do the discovery, learn what needs to be true for that product feature to exist and succeed with customers and drive value for the company.
So if you are on one side of the spectrum and you're completely output driven, if there's a leader listening to this conversation, what can she do to actually flip it to an outcome-oriented management? What are the first steps that you would recommend? And what are the things that she needs to have in place to be able to do that?
So there are these things that tend to go together, right? There's usually, for companies that have been solely output driven for a number of years, there tends to be a lot of products that exist but aren't widely used, aren't delivering much value, usually don't have teams dedicated to them anymore because they were all projects to be delivered and the success was it launched. And so the first thing is, you know, some sort of recognition that that is problematic, that we have these things that now we're spending a lot of, you know, engineering resources maintaining. Maybe they're not quite working. They're not delivering the value. There has to be some level of pain in the status quo. Could be even more potent than that. It could be we've delivered things that are really hurting our customers or hurting our company, or we've been leapfrogged by competitors. There has to be some tangible pain in continuing to operate in that way. And the more that a company has sort of a graveyard of products that are unused and not valuable, or we're feeling the competitive pressure to be more innovative and more customer-centric, that tends to be the fuel that can foster a leader and get some, you know, tailwinds to them pursuing a more outcome-oriented way of working. There's also things when we have projects, which is typically the case in an output-oriented organization, that are like at least early enough that they can be influenced. We can start to use those. We're not questioning whether we should do it, but we are going to set some measures of success that are outcomes, leading indicators of whether we're on the right track or not. And we can start to use that as a way of introducing more outcome-oriented ways of working to the company, to the leadership team. But that same leader also has to usually recognize that the skills on their team are probably not well suited to that style of operating, right? Because output-oriented teams, if you succeed in an output-oriented environment as a product team member, what has made you successful is delivering the things on time, not questioning whether this is the right thing to deliver, and not taking the time and building the skills to do assumption testing and set measures of success. So you have to recognize that you probably don't have the skill sets within your organization to successfully navigate to that way of working. So you have to find some teams that you can quickly upskill, or maybe they had that way of working in previous jobs that they can leverage to start creating a pilot team on a pilot initiative, we'll call it, to start introducing those ways of working. That's what I tend to see helping teams and companies and leaders navigate to that. But it's not a quick fix. It's not going to be an overnight. We're completely pivoting to the other end of the spectrum.
Okay, so you've said so many interesting things there. So you've talked about first the graveyard, basically, which I totally agree. It really helps nudge. Hey, you need to transform. You need to do something different. And then you also talked about the competency of the teams, because shifting from output-oriented practices to outcome, it requires product leaders to have the guardrails that you mentioned, which is basically product strategy, product vision, and so on, product principles. But it also requires teams to be competent to be able to discover the best solutions to solve those problems. So I just wanted to, before we move on, just wanted to dig a bit deeper into this. So you've talked about a pilot team, like a team that might already have some skills. Where do you start? Like, do you train these people? Do you focus a lot on coaching? What are some of the best practices, let's say, to help that transformation from an organization who's totally focused on outputs these days?
Yeah, and this is why I think this, like, making this shift is so challenging, because usually a product leader in that organization, again, it maybe if they're a brand new product leader who knows what it looks like to work in a product operating model with outcome-oriented, mm-hmm. empowered teams, can do some talent assessment within their organization, right? And they can see, do I have any individuals that are expecting to work this way, have experience working that way? But if you're a leader who's only ever worked in and out, it's very difficult for you to assess the talent on your team, right? You don't know what good looks like. It's very tricky. So if you can't identify it, again, it's like having job interviews with your team, right? Tell me about a time when you set an outcome for a product. Tell me about a time when you successfully de-risked or identified, risky assumptions associated with a product that you were in development on. You can have these discussions with your team, but you have to know how to assess the gaps. And then it could be training. It could be coaching. There's different ways that you can sort of rectify the skills gap, but you as a leader, like, it's still not enough, right? Like, you can have a perfectly skilled team that you can pluck out of your organization and put together and hope that they gel well together. And you still have to make sure that your leadership team knows how they need to behave differently to support the success of this team, right? Yeah. How to appropriately check in on the progress the team's making, how to create the rituals so the team can show what they're learning and get quick feedback or decisions if they're not sure if something is viable in their company or they need to, make decisions to help them pivot to a more likely path to success. So there's multiple things that you have to navigate as a leader, which is why most transformations require bringing in an experienced product leader who has the willingness and fortitude to tackle both at the team level and at their peer group level on the executive team to teach the whole organization new ways of working. That's why a pilot team can start to create a space to put those into practice, uncover all the hard, things, challenges, ways of working, things that we feel most comfortable with and things that we feel least comfortable with to help navigate to new ways of working.
Very well said. So totally agree with you that having a strong product leader makes things so much easier, because it's going to, that product leader will be able to hire the right talent. He'll be able to coach the teams. We'll be able to set the right strategic context and lead with strategic context. We'll be able to assign the right objectives to the right team based on their competency and the problem they should be solving. So it's just it's a massive difference. But I see, I don't know if this is a challenge in the US, Hope, but in Scandinavia, for example, and in Europe, you do see a lack of product leadership. So if there's anyone listening to this conversation and so, for example, a product manager or even a designer thinking, oh my God, but I don't have a product leader, or my product leader is not doing any of those things. Mm-hmm. What can they do, Hope? What are some of the things that teams can do?
That's great. And I will say it's tricky because you have to have the right sort of mindset within the team. Like, there are things, I have agency, there are things I can do. I know that there are better ways of working. I see risks ahead that I want to, de-risk, make sure that we're more likely to succeed. So it starts with that mindset in the team. And then they have to assess, like, do I know what to do? right? And that's really hard if you've never done it before. If you've done it before, or you're at least inspired by what you've learned or read or, you know, watched or seen case studies around, there are things that you can do to de-risk. Like the first thing that we usually tell people to do is start talking to customers every week, right? Like that's a good place to start. It takes effort. There are some companies that put a lot of barriers up to their teams being able to talk to customers. And you may have to break down some of those barriers. You may have to go rogue and talk to customers and work around some of those, you know, rules. But the sooner you do that, you start to find insights that the rest of the organization doesn't have. And that's where you start to get momentum as a product team. If you are finding out things that the rest of the organization already knows, the initial reaction is going to be, well, this is a waste of time. Like we're spending time, we're delaying the inevitable. We're just like learning things that we already know. But if you can approach understanding what a customer is doing instead of using the product that maybe you have today or that you are working to develop, and you can understand what's working well for them, what isn't working well for them, do some value proposition testing, right? You can start to bring those insights into the conversation and say, you know, I learned this thing and I'm worried that like if we keep going down this path with this value proposition or this feature set, that it won't be well adopted or received by customers. And I feel like we could maybe change it. And maybe now let's do a prototype. Let's see if that's more acceptable, more valuable to customers. So you can start at the team level, introducing these ways of working. But I would focus on don't regurgitate what the rest of the organization already believes and knows to be true. You have to look for those surprising insights for people to value you spending time on this.
That's very good advice. So, let's assume that those teams are actually uncovering those insights, and then, you know, it will be easier for them to find those outcomes, the outcomes that we want to achieve, which will then, you know, packed up in a great story, will potentially drive some change in the organization and with leaders that may not be, you know, the strong product leaders that people would wish they had. So when we get to that point of having outcomes and we all agree, there's of course different types of outcomes, and I wanted to hear that from you. What are the main types of outcomes that we should be thinking of?
Yeah, so there's sort of a few layers to that question, but the first thing that I would do is like, especially if you're a team that is trying to sort of from the ground up introduce new ways of working to your organization, right? Like nobody is going to come down and say, here's a great outcome for you to work towards. If you're working on something that's in development and you're talking to customers and you're starting to look at the assumptions behind your product and test those, you can start to formulate your own outcome, right? Odds are nobody's going to hold you accountable to that because they're probably still expecting you to hit a date. So, but you can say, okay, let's say we do deliver this thing on time. What would be the behavior from our customers that we would be able to measure or observe once it's released? You know, the day it's released, the day after it's released, 2 days after it's released, a week after it's released, what would we expect to measure or observe that would tell us it's working? And that can start to give you a draft of an outcome. And you may start with a directional outcome. So I'm going to describe sort of three types of outcomes, which are sort of varying from general to specific. So the first is a directional outcome. So it might be they're using it. That might be the first level of outcome that you're looking for. How often would you expect them to use it? Is this something that they should be using every day, once a week, once a month? After a certain trigger event, right, you can start to get a direction. We would expect some of our customers would use it at least weekly, right? So we have sort of a directional outcome, something we could measure, observe, but we're not very specific. The next layer would be that it becomes more measurable, right? We can actually see, maybe we start with qualitative, depends on whether you've instrumented your product, starts to become more measurable. We see that 20% of our customers use it every day, and 13% of them use it at least once a week. Okay, so now we've got a more measurable outcome. The third level is now it's measurable and we're setting a target. So if you have, and this is where we start to deviate from a project-oriented team and an output-oriented organization to a durable, empowered product team in an outcome-oriented organization, that team stays with that product, right? The end isn't the launch. The end, there's no real end. It keeps going until we feel like we've got diminishing returns on continuing to invest in that product. It might move into sunset or it might move into maintenance. But we have a goal. It might be we want to see at least 60% of our users doing something in the product every weekday. So now we're, okay, we're at 24% today. So we're trying to get it up to 60%. So now we've set it with a target. So those are the three levels of outcomes: directional, measurable, measurable with a target. Now, I gave you more of a behavior-based example. They're using it. They're doing something with it. There's some level of frequency. There's some percentage of our customers. Those are the most common product outcomes. And usually engagement, right? Some level of that. There are other types of outcomes. Some teams have sentiment-based outcomes, like NPS or CSAT or customer effort score or some sort of perception level of outcome. Usually, we recommend that those are best paired with a behavior-based outcome. So like there's different categories. There's some teams that have business outcomes, financial measures of success, get to X amount in ARR, get to X million in revenue by the end of the year. So like there's a lot of different types of outcomes, but the most common one that we recommend is a product outcome, which means it's a measure of customer behavior within the realm of influence of the product team. It's something we can measure early and often. It's a leading indicator of the financial success that we seek, which is typically our business outcome: cost reduction, cost avoidance, revenue growth. So I'll pause there because there's a lot there was, in outcomes.
So brilliant. So I love the spectrum that you described, from directional to
was measurable.
Measurable with a target.
Yes.
Exactly. So I love that. So, and then, you know, the whole focus on product outcomes with gradually a focus on those leading indicators actually leading to the business lagging indicators that we do want to see move, yet it's most of the times outside of the control of the teams, of the product teams. So it requires collaboration with sales, marketing, whatnot. And so that's, I love that because it's a clear pitfall for many product teams is that, yeah, let's use outcomes and then, okay, increase revenue by X. And then nobody really owns it. They need sales, they need marketing, they need X and Y, Z teams. And so basically that that whole model breaks and people go back to output management because it didn't work.
Yep, that's so true.
But I love that the way you described it because it's so simple and it really forces us to think on about product outcomes and how can we transform them or see that story between product outcomes and business outcomes. But so I want to ask, in the occasion of having some business outcomes for assigned to a product team, is it then that you do your best to transform those business outcomes to product outcomes? And if you can't, do you then share those outcomes with sales or marketing and so on? How do you approach owning a business outcome as a product team, basically?
Yeah. So I'll give you an example with a company I was working with yesterday. In the travel space, a woman that I was speaking to at that company, she's like, I've got hundreds of opportunities and I don't know how to even choose which one to work on. And I said, well, what's your outcome? What's your measure of success? She said, increase cross-sell revenue. And so I said, okay, tell me more about that. What do you mean by cross? Is that insurance? Is that car rentals? Is it hotels? Like, what do you mean? She's like, it's like car rentals and hotels. I'm like, okay, great. So when we think about cross-sell revenue, and a lot of product teams have either revenue related business outcomes or cost reduction or cost avoidance if they're more internal facing product teams. But let's use this revenue example. The revenue formula, I imagine, for a cross sell would be like number of people making a flight purchase in this case, times the percentage of people who might potentially need a car rental or hotel in the destination that they're traveling. They're not staying with friends and family. They don't, you know, it's not walkable, right? Like, I don't know. So some percentage of people times the percent that actually explore these cross-sell options, times the percent that selects one of these cross-sell options, times the value of that cross-sell option, the price point, times the commission that they earn, right? Like there's a whole revenue formula there. And I said, so which portion are you focused on? Is it the like choosing at least one of the cross-sell offers? Is it average order size? Right. But none of that strategic context had been given to this product manager. Right. And this is the lack of leadership, right? Saying it's more or and again, it doesn't have to be the leadership. It could be the team doing a diagnosis if their product is instrumented to say, like, when people choose an upsell, they're choosing high value, but not enough people are choosing it, right? That would be a more strategic diagnosis. We need to get more people choosing the cross-sell options, or maybe plenty of people choose it, but it's a low price point. Like you could focus on increasing revenue either way, but that's where you start to do the diagnosis as a team. And you could choose any one of those and layer your opportunities underneath that if you use the opportunity solution tree to help you choose what to do next, what to learn next in your discovery, what to potentially solution against in terms of a target opportunity to drive towards that business outcome. So what I suggested for her was maybe, again, I don't have the data. If you don't have the data, let's just pick something. And if it turns out to be wrong, if you focus on like increasing the percentage of flight purchasers who choose at least one cross-sell option, a car rental or a hotel or both, if that turns out to be a low impact outcome to work on, and it's and 99% of people are choosing a cross-sell and it's better to focus on increasing average order value, you can always switch. But start with something. It's an informed decision if you can break it out, if you can layer in the data. And then you've got something to put guardrails around. You've got hundreds of opportunities. I bet not all of them are barriers to choosing a cross-sell. So now we can set the scope of what we need to learn, what opportunities we might potentially solve. This is why the outcome is so critical for a product team to set the scope of their discovery and make sure that they can calibrate. Are we moving that needle? Are we seeing more and more people choose a cross-sell when they're making a flight purchase?
Very good. So, okay. So basically understanding all the little business outcomes and every single lagging indicator that might be moving that is important for your financial equation, basically the whole business model in one equation. And then try to work backwards to try to find a few product outcomes that could potentially lead to those lagging indicators. And if you're not sure, then just try it out, just experiment, go and discover what does move the needle, what makes the needle move. Is that it? Did I get it right?
Yeah, right. Because like if it's part of the revenue formula, moving any one of those inputs in the formula will have a positive impact on revenue. They're just not all equally impactful. So if you don't have the data, pick one. If you get the data, choose the one that's the biggest point of leverage.
Gotcha. So for folks listening to this and thinking immediately, well, yeah, I can think of an outcome, but it will be probably shared with marketing, for example. You know, I wouldn't be able, even if we kind of descope it, it would still be shared. What do you recommend in those cases? Do you recommend stuff like shared OKRs, or what do you recommend?
Yeah, I think that's, if you feel like, and this is true for a lot of B2C products, right? If they're trying to drive customer acquisition or revenue growth as a goal, often it might be shared with like an SEO team or a marketing team or a growth team, or right? Like there could be different ones. And I think this is where team topology comes into play, right? Like what is truly within our realm of influence versus what's like, if the growth team is responsible for it, maybe you don't need to focus on it as a team. But if you feel like, no, like this is like who we get to come to our site is more in the realm of influence of marketing, and that, and like we can't convert people if we've got a lot of low quality or, you know, not fitting our target customer profile coming to our site. So we like, it's affecting our ability to convert, then you should have a conversation with the marketing team to understand what their measures of success are, because they might be driving to a low cost per visit success metric. And if low cost per visit leads to low conversion rate, then it's important for you to negotiate with that team and maybe raise awareness to leaders and maybe do some experiments. What if we changed the types of marketing that we were doing to see if it had an impact on conversion rate, right? So like, this is where you might want to share an outcome with that team, or you might want to at least be comparing experiments with that team to see the degree to which they are related or having an impact on one another. So definitely having shared measures of success, but again, different realms of influence, right? Marketing team is going to impact who comes to the site, you know, and then once they get to the site, are we moving them through that conversion funnel? But if it's the wrong people, then that's a shared, you know, that's a risk to mitigate. And that might be something you share with another team. And this is where, you know, having like an opportunity solution tree with maybe a shared business outcome of like increasing new customer orders or something like that, there might be a marketing team element to that and a product team element to that, but they can be working towards a shared business outcome, different realms of influence.
Nice. Just out of curiosity, a bit out of script, but have you seen a lot of marketing teams using opportunity solution trees as well?
Yeah, in B2C companies that I've worked with, because this sort of happens, once the product team starts moving to outcome ways of working, and this is, we're choosing to solve this opportunity and not this opportunity, all of a sudden the sort of adjacent teams are like, wait a minute, but you're not doing the thing that I thought you should be doing. And so then we can have a transparent conversation about, you know, what was our, you know, criteria for choosing this opportunity. And then it sort of begs the question, well, if you're not working towards, like if you're just campaign execution with no measure of success, that's going to have an impact on how well our teams are. And again, this is where you want the product leader to have strong relationships with the engineering leader, with maybe the marketing leader, with the sales leader, right? Like, are we selling to customers that don't fit our target customer profile, and then we can't get them onboarded? So is that an onboarding team problem? Is that a product team problem? Is that a sales problem? Like all these things ladder up to those business outcomes.
I love that because, you know, this is a great segue to leading with outcomes, kind of core of this conversation that I wanted to have as well. Because so far we've been talking a lot about the teams and how can this dynamic happen and things that they can do. But, you know, having those outcomes assigned to the teams is incredibly powerful. And as you said very well, for that product leader to be able to collaborate across the organization and influence and you know, communicate and so on, it's so important. So the question I have is, how specific should the product leader be when it comes to crafting those outcomes to be assigned to the teams?
Yeah, so we recommend it's a two-way negotiation. So there's not really an assignment of outcomes. Usually the leader is keenly aware of what the business outcomes are for the year, right? Like that's talked about in every exec meeting. It's talked about in board meetings. Like there's usually a lot of certainty about what the desired business outcomes are for the year. But the teams, they know again, depending on the degree to which they are meeting with customers and understanding the competition and understanding the behaviors of customers using the product or not using the product and what those opportunities are, can share how much progress they can make in what sort of time frame. So it's a two-way negotiation. So what I usually recommend is, like, the leader should be really clear. Hey, we want you to focus on retention. We're worried about, you know, having a leaky bucket. We're worried about losing customers to a competitor or whatever it is. Okay, what would be the leading predictors of retention? What are the, like, often it's some sort of engagement product outcome, right? If they're not using the product, or they're not using it as often or in the ways we expect, what are the odds they're going to keep that product for much longer? So that's where it's a two-way negotiation with the teams. And this is also where the leader and the teams have to have, you know, what are our progress check-ins? And that's different from status update meetings on, you know, like the Gantt charts of project updates. It's, you know, what opportunities are you solving? Oh, you solved that opportunity. How much impact did that make on your outcome? So this is the way that we can have sort of a continuous learning cycle and provide transparency to the leader and the rest of the organization about, are we on track to be likely to hit those financial metrics at the end of the year? So that's where it's a two-way negotiation, and you have to have ongoing rituals. You can't say, okay, cool, update me at the end of the quarter on how that went. That doesn't give enough, you know, frequency of learning expectations with the team and force us into shorter learning cycles.
Absolutely. That's a brilliant point. Having a healthy negotiation between product leadership and product teams, super important. Product leaders, is it the case that they draft, in some cases, they even draft the business outcomes, the product outcomes that they think would be best, because they're working together anyway, it doesn't come as a surprise. And then when that conversation happens, kind of everybody knows already if the strategic context is there before. But then there's that conversation, which is so important and almost the proof that there is psychological safety in the team as well, for them to have that conversation and sort of challenge the direction and how they might measure those outcomes. So that's kind of what great looks like, Hope, when you see that negotiation happens.
I think a team should draft the outcomes, right? That way they've got buy-in. They know what's more within their realm of influence. They know, again, if they're close to their customers, learning from their customers every week, they know what the good behaviors are. The engaged customers or the likely to convert customers tend to do these types of behaviors. So we think these are the things, or they've done some sort of regression and looked at, okay, our customers with the highest retention rate tend to have this sort of behavior profile in terms of their product adoption or usage. So I always have the teams draft a few options so we can make a strategic decision, a compare and contrast decision. We could do this product outcome or this product outcome or this product outcome. We think all of those would be leading, or one might be easier to measure or, you know, more predictive that towards this desired business outcome. And then they can reflect that back to the leader and they can decide which one they want to focus on. The heavy lift is usually the first time a team is negotiating. If it's a durable product team, if the strategic context doesn't change, right, we're still focused on retention, the product outcome, maybe the target changes, but conceptually the outcome doesn't change that much, right? Okay, we were at 13%, we're trying to get to 60%. This quarter, we're trying to get from 13% to 20%. And next quarter, okay, we got to 18%. Okay, next quarter, let's see if we can get to 25%. So like the conceptually, it doesn't change that much unless strategic context changes. Don't worry about retention. We got to focus on growth. Or the team learns something. Oh, we thought that, you know, them doing this behavior once a week was predictive. It turns out if they do this other behavior every day, it's a stronger prediction. So we think we're going to shift focus to driving this, or we want to focus on this, like, you know, customer segment that's not very engaged with our product. So they can renegotiate that once they've got the data and evidence to tell them that they think there's actually a better measure of success for them to work towards. But I have it start with the team, and then the leader can react to it.
Nice. So in Scandinavia, I think that happens a lot because, you know, usually in Scandinavia, organizations are extremely flat. So culturally, it's very common for that dynamic to happen. So it's less sort of hierarchical in that sense. So the question sometimes I often get is, okay, well, if let's say you have a very senior team who's able to, you know, understand the full creative strategic context and who's able to draft the outcomes and you know, decide the right measures of progress and so on. What's then the role of the product leader, you think, in those cases?
Yeah, I think then you're coaching and unblocking, right? So this is where those rituals of like how much progress have you made? What have you learned recently? Like, what have you released recently? What's the impact of that been on your outcome? Having these rituals, they could be in the form of, I like to do discovery and delivery demos, right? Like, what have we learned recently? Does that mean that we're still working on the right opportunity? Does that mean that our solution that we're conceiving of is likely to succeed? Or are we changing course? We're picking a new opportunity because we think it's more impactful. Did we deliver something recently? What's been the adoption? Have we run some sort of a prototype test or, any sort of, you know, maybe we've done a other assumption test. So having those rituals, especially when the other teams can see, again, this goes back to the pilot team. If you've got at least one team working that way and the other teams can be exposed to their short learning cycles and seeing progress on their measure of success, it does great things for leadership buy-in to these ways of working. And it helps foster curiosity and desire to self-improve and change habits. What could we do to be more like that team? They look like they're having more fun. They look like they're contributing more value. It looks like they're making more decisions of their own, you know, conviction as opposed to doing what others have told them. And so this is where you can create that environment as a leader by shining a spotlight on good habits. And when you see a team inevitably maybe taking too long or focusing on an assumption that isn't that risky, we don't really need to learn about it, you can, you know, course correct as a leader to say, you know what, don't worry about that. That's fine. It's a, you know, we can live with that risk. This is a risk maybe we should be more concerned about. And what are fast ways we could de-risk it? So that's the role of the leader at that point. It's coaching and unblocking.
Coaching and unblocking. I love that. So for more junior teams, let's say that you are a strong product leader coming into an organization who's output driven and the teams haven't really done product as you would see in a strong product organization.
Yep.
Are you then as a leader a little bit more hands-on on trying to draft those outcomes and having a more sort of more hands-on approach on drafting what those outcomes should be? Or you still try to ask great questions instead and do coaching and unblocking, basically?
I think, look, you have to decide the level of risk. So, like, you could be more prescriptive with the outcome for an immature team that hasn't had a lot of experience drafting outcomes or making progress towards outcomes. Are you going to get the same level of buy-in as they would if they had drafted it themselves? Even if you don't choose, maybe you propose a fourth alternative to the three they proposed, but you want to encourage them to do that harder thinking, that strategic thinking on their own. Because if you're just gonna say, nope, it's gonna be this way, you're not fostering that skills development in your team. So there's the fast way, there's the effective way. So like you have to decide the risks, right? Like it may be a team has spent, you know, like I had another team that I was working with that were very output oriented. And it took us 12 weeks for them to recognize that an outcome would be more effective for them. And all they wanted to do was talk about, well, we're going to do these things on these dates. So like, not every team is going to get there at the same rate. And so you as a leader have to decide where you're going to invest your time. There may be some teams that like they don't want to work that way. Frankly, it's easier. It's not very empowering, but it's easier to just do what you're told to do and be like, well, if that was the wrong thing, that wasn't my decision. So as a leader, you have to decide what types of risks you're willing to tolerate in how you choose to work with your teams.
Very interesting. I love that perspective. So what are some of the pitfalls? Then let's move into, you know, you've seen so many teams, Hope. What are some of the main pitfalls that teams do when adopting continuous discovery habits that you've seen?
Yeah, I think one of the first things, and this comes up as an objection all the time, is the time. Like, oh my gosh, like I am already, my meetings, you know, my day is filled with meetings. Like I'm always working, you know, like 12-hour days to hit this date. And now you're telling me on top of that, I have to de-risk it and do all these other like customer interviews and assumption tests. Like that's the first thing that usually gives teams resistance. Even if conceptually they're like, sure, I'd love to be an empowered team. The initial reaction is, oh my gosh, you're basically adding work to my plate. So you as a leader have to, again, find a team that is working on something where it's more important to hit the outcome than hit the date, right? So that, because there's a learning tax. The first time we're learning how to do these things, like we're not going to be that efficient, right? We're going to, like, again, I'll go back to this other team that I'm working with. They were rolling out a test for, I won't be specific. They were rolling out a test. And they said, so it's live and it's getting an 80% conversion rate. And they're like, so we're going to wait till 5,000 people have gone through the test. And I was like, what, why? Why are you waiting for, how long is that going to take? I don't know. This is the first time we've ever run a test. Well, how did you pick 5,000? I don't know. That's what the product manager said. Like, I'm like, okay. So like, there's going to be some of these moments that you're going to encounter with teams and a leader who are used to new ways of working where they aren't taking, you know, short learning cycles. They're worried about time, but they're also taking, you know, extraordinary time to run their assumption tests. So like there are these pitfalls, but like the principle is what's the fastest way we could learn what needs to be true to de-risk this risky assumption, which means we have to identify the riskiest assumptions associated with the decisions we're making. We have to distinguish between one-way door decisions and two-way door decisions. A lot of teams haven't ever thought about that. They've only thought about everything they've built as a one-way door decision because they work in an environment where we build the thing and we never come back to it. So it feels like everything is high stakes. But when you're in a durable team where you can evolve and like, oh, well, that interface didn't work out as well as we thought it was going to, we can evolve it. We can change it because we're not moving on to the next project. So those are just some of the pitfalls that, and it's a lot of mindset and inexperience that you need to look for and quickly course correct for as a leader. And this is why, again, an experienced product leader is usually helpful in these situations where teams are moving from output to outcome, because how can you know to look out for those things and how would you know how to course correct them if you're not an experienced product leader working this way? That's the rub for product leaders who are trying to work this way but are going through that learning tax for the first time.
I agree. And I see that some folks that work with hardware, for example, B2B, that learning takes even longer because the cycles are so long. Sometimes they start talking about the outcomes and they tell me, well, but Jesus, this is going to take months or, you know, even years sometimes. Do you have any, have you worked with the hardware folks before? Like how, what kind of tricks can we use in a hardware environment?
I haven't done a ton. I definitely emphasize more of my work is on digital product experiences, but a lot of, you know, companies these days have a combination of like I was working with a large healthcare company that has like a lot of digital, you know, connected devices used in operating environments and things like that. And so there are different cycle times. There's different deployment times. There's different, you know, we've got different compliance risks to mitigate, right? So there's always something that might be unique to the style of product or the customer or the regulatory environment that your products are being released in. And those are real constraints. And so, like, to me, that is also why it's so critical to make sure that you're looking for what are the opportunities where we can learn what needs to be true as quickly as possible, right? Even hardware, we can do prototype testing, right? We may have to do more, more physical prototypes, or we may need to do more observations of our customers in their environment with their existing equipment. Like, there's still ways that we can learn to keep those learning cycles short, even if our deployments or adoption cycles might be longer. We can still, again, more important that we de-risk early before we release it and see the long adoption cycles, only to see that we actually miss the mark entirely.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So Hope, you've seen so many different contexts and you've worked with so many different teams. I would love to ask you, is there anything you have changed your mind on recently? Is there anything you've changed your mind on?
Well, I feel like I'm constantly learning. One of the things that has troubled me is whether, you know, I like to be optimistic. I like to think like everybody would like to work this way. Everybody would see the benefit. But I mentioned that one team that took 12 weeks to even get to the recognition of, maybe an outcome would be helpful to our decision making, right? Like, I think it's important to work with willing people. And so I constantly want to give people the benefit of the doubt. Like, if you see examples, if we can work within your context, if we can address your worries, fears, concerns, you will be more likely to work this way. And I think that's not always true. You know, people are human, and, you know, some people are more risk averse than others. Some people are more courageous than others. Some people are like, this is a job to me. Like, it's not my life's calling. I don't really care that much. And that's fine. Like, maybe we shouldn't work together. So I think that's maybe something that I had hoped to change my mind around. And now I feel like I'm just doing a better job at maybe recognizing it and giving people options to say, maybe this isn't for you. And that's okay. You might still be able to be successful in the environment you're working in. But if I'm a leader with somebody like that, I'm not putting them on my most, you know, valuable, important strategic initiatives.
Where can people find you, Hope?
You can find me on my website, fearless-product.com. You can find me on LinkedIn, you know, the usual.
Perfect. Hope, thank you so much for this conversation. I had such a great time. I've learned a lot, and I'm pretty sure this conversation will be very insightful for many people. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me. That's very thoughtful.
All right, that was it for today. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Make sure you subscribe to my newsletter so you don't miss out, and see you next time.